Hello, this is Eugenie Scott and Nick Motzke at the Harrisburg Kitzmiller versus Dover trial in Federal District Court. We apologize that we have not been able to get a running commentary up. It is, alas, Tuesday, September 27th, the second day of the case, but as many people who are listening to this blog know, NCSC has been acting as a scientific advisor to the legal team since the beginning of this case. And frankly, we've just been too busy doing things that needed to be done to really sit down and do much of this. But we're going to try to do this every day from now on. But we have 2 days to kind of get through, don't we, Nick?
That's correct.
So why don't we start out by trying to give you listeners a little bit of a feeling of what it's like in the courthouse, what it's like in the courtroom itself, which is, as described in one news account, indeed a oak-trimmed, windowless, stuffy room. Seats about how many? There's what, 4 or 5 benches on the
side? There's probably about 60 seats in the back, and then there's probably another 20 seats on sort of the front rows, and then many of the press sat in the jury box on the left side of the courtroom when you're facing forward.
Overflow.
Yes, and there were a few jokes about that.
Yes. But there's a little area, kind of a little separate corral, as it were, where the lawyers sit. And on the right-hand side are the lawyers for the plaintiff. On the left-hand side is the table for the lawyers for the defense. And there's a whole lot more people on the right-hand side. For one thing, the plaintiffs in Kitzmiller versus Dover are a group of Dover parents, and they are defended by the ACLU, a law firm in Pennsylvania, Pepper Hamilton, and also Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It's probably a good thing to correct right off the bat, because there's been an awful lot of publicity around about the ACLU's case.
Yes, and the ACLU has been a significant contributor to the case, but honestly, most of the lawyers have come from Pepper Hamilton, the Philadelphia law firm, and they've provided most of the legal muscle.
And money.
And money, which is not an insignificant thing. And however, it's been a close cooperation between those three legal groups, and NCSE, which has been consulting for the plaintiffs, has been involved from the beginning.
But of course, I think an even more important point is that the plaintiffs are not the ACLU or Pepper or Americans United. The plaintiffs are a group of concerned Dover parents who are really fed up with what their school board has done to them. And nobody's terribly happy about this case. Remember, we had a nice reception the night before all this started. It was Saturday night.
Saturday night before the case, yes.
Yeah, where we got a chance to meet the plaintiffs in person, which was really fun for us, I think. And their families. And all
yes.
the kids running
and
all over.
And their kids and pets and all kinds of things.
Yeah, it was great. But in talking with these parents, these plaintiffs, yes, they were very excited about the trial coming up, but they've actually put up with a lot. I mean, they've had to put up with sometimes people looking at them funny in the supermarket checkout lines, and their kids getting comments at school and so forth. But they do feel strongly that they don't want their children being taught religious doctrine in the science class. And they are also concerned about their students getting good science education. So one of the big differences is not just the large number of lawyers on the one side. On the other side, let's finish talking about the plaintiff's side. Also, the plaintiffs have three legal aides who do an awful lot of the heavy lifting around here. Truly, we've learned a lot about how to run a court case.
Yes, have lots of legal aides that don't sleep. Three young paralegals have really done a huge amount of work, especially in the last week, getting together hundreds of exhibits which are involved in this case. They like to say that for a non-document intensive case, which is I think a legal term of art, this case has a lot of documents, and you know they've been wheeling them back and forth with push carts because there've been so many. So you know it's been an awful lot of work getting this case together.
It really has.
The one other feature that we should describe that the plaintiffs have made a lot of use of is they hired a technology company, and they have a projector and a screen that's hooked into a computer system, and most of the exhibits have gone up on this computer screen so that the people in the court can see it, The judge can see it, and actually there's several individual monitors for the plaintiffs and the defense and the judge and for the witnesses, but also so everyone else can see it. And because there's so many different documents and also a lot of science in this case, it's been very helpful to have that technology available, and it's actually worked very smoothly.
Yeah, the young man who's running the technology is very, very competent and very smooth, and so all, as we will talk about Ken Miller's very sciencey presentation that took place mostly yesterday, things went remarkably well. I mean, as an ex-college professor, I wish my use of visuals had gone that smoothly.
We should give him a plug just for free here. It's Trial Technologies is his company, so it's been working very well.
I didn't know that, and I'm glad you plugged him.
Yes.
So I think that on the other side, on the defense side, we have three lawyers, a man by the name of Muse and Thompson and Gillen. These are the three defendants' lawyers, all of whom are associated with the Thomas More Law Institute, which you can read about in other pages on the NCSC website here. And the three main plaintiff's lawyers are Eric Rothschild for Pepper Hamilton, and of course Steve Schmidt for Pepper Hamilton. Steve Harvey.
Yes, from Pepper Hamilton.
Right. Vic Walczak from the ACLU.
ACLU of Pennsylvania,
right.
Yes.
And Richard Katsky from the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Eric Rothschild had the opening statement, which started pretty promptly a minute or so after 9 o'clock in the morning on Monday. And of course, he made a point that really the big idea that's going to be expressed in this trial is that intelligent design is a religious view. Maybe we should just take a moment, Nick, and just kind of outline a little bit what the major issues are from a legal standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
What the defense has to argue, what the Dover School District has to argue, is that the policy that they put into effect has a secular purpose for being there. It may have a secondary religious purpose, but they have to argue that it has a primary secular effect for being there. And we imagine, logically, that the secular effect they're going to argue is two reasons. One is that intelligent design is good science, and two, that teaching intelligent design and the gaps/problems of evolution are good pedagogy, that students will benefit from having been taught this, their education will be enhanced, etc. On the plaintiff's side, we obviously our side has to make the opposite point, that the claim that intelligent design is religious, has a secular purpose and effect is a sham, and that there is in fact no secular purpose or effect for teaching intelligent design. The sole purpose and effect is religious. And we will also be arguing that there is no valid pedagogical reason for teaching bad science. So Eric Rothschild got us started with his opening remarks, which tend to be very short. The big idea, of course, is that intelligent design is a religious view, and like creation science, it is unconstitutional to teach it. He said that the Dover School Board did everything they could do to present a religious view without the consideration of its scientific value. And he said he would be supporting this by bringing in the depositions of two of the school board members in particular, a man named Bonzel and a man named Buckingham, and the superintendent, who's a man named Nilsson. He talked about Bonzel in particular having made a number of statements in which the idea of balancing evolution with something else was very important, and of course that something else was creationism. He also listed the witnesses that would be coming up for the plaintiffs, and Ken Miller, who would be talking about science of evolution and nature of science and why intelligent design is not a good science. Barbara Forrest would be testifying about the history of intelligent design and about the wedge strategy. The theologian John Haught would make the point that intelligent design is old theology, not science, and not a universal theology. That is, it is in fact a sectarian religious view. And making it sectarian is obviously very important for this argument that the plaintiffs have to make, that there is no secular purpose, there is a religious purpose. One of the points, of course, that the intelligent design people make is that intelligent design is science in its infancy, and Eric Rothschild made it clear that ID was not science in its infancy, it was not science at all. Very nicely put, I thought. He talked about methodological naturalism and its importance to science, and how that would become that would be an important aspect of the plaintiff's position in its arguments over the next few weeks, and that if you can't measure it, you can't observe it, you can't test it, it is not science, and you cannot rely upon supernatural events, which of course is the problem with intelligent design. And he had an interesting phrase in there. He said, intelligent design rejects methodological naturalism because it has to, which I thought was nice. ID does rely upon the miracles. And he brought it back to the legal issues at the end of his presentation, and pointed out, I think, very succinctly that even though the Dover School District claims that this is a minor policy, it's just something read to students, it's not important, Eric pointed out that there's no such thing as a little constitutional violation. And I thought that was a very good point. And he mentioned that they would be arguing on the purpose and effect clauses of the Lemon Test. How's that for a summary?
That's a very good summary. Let me just add one little tidbit that was put up on the screen during Eric Rothschild's opening statement.
Oh, yes.
And that was quotes from a book called Pandas and People, of Pandas and People. The second edition was published in 1993. The first edition was published in 1989. And this book is the book recommended by the Dover Area School Board to its ninth grade biology students. And it's listed as a reference in the intelligent design section that was added to the curriculum. Now, the history of this book is very interesting. This will be explored in more detail later on in the case, especially by Barbara Forrest, an expert witness who's going to go into the history and origin of intelligent design. But just to start it off, Eric Rothschild picked two quotes, one from the published version of Pandas and People, which argues for intelligent design, and one for an earlier version of the book that was a draft that was produced during discovery in the case. And so I'll read the published version first, just the one quote that was used in the opening statement. The quote is, intelligent design means that various forms of life began abruptly through an intelligent agency with their distinctive features already intact. Fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks, and wings, etc. That's from pages 99 to 100 if you're interested. And even by itself, that's clearly special creation. That's the instantaneous creation of organisms sometime in the past, and essentially the poof mechanism, poof, a miracle happened, and that's the origin of organisms. So that's the intelligent design view, as stated in the intelligent design textbook, Pandas and People. Now, up on the screen, Eric Rothschild also put a draft of the book called Biology and Creation. It had a copyright of 1986. This was an unpublished draft, but a draft of the intelligent design book, Pandas and People. So the first thing to note is that there was a draft called Biology and Creation. And here is the sentence. Creation means that the various forms of life began abruptly through the agency of an intelligent creator with their distinctive features already intact. Fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks, and wings, etc. So it's just about the same sentence, and the word has been switched from creation to intelligent design. That was a fairly significant point. So Eric Rothschild, in the opening statement, argued both that the school district's purposes and effects of their policy were going to be unconstitutional because they were essentially religious, and that they, in fact, he highlighted several statements from the school board members about teaching creationism, using the word creationism, not intelligent design, which was a late feature of their policy in the Dover Area School District. And he went into the movement generally, the intelligent design movement generally, which repeats this process in history back in the late 1980s, where the term creation was switched to the term intelligent design somewhere between 1986 and 1989. And the importance of this will become even more apparent later on in the case, I suspect. So
that's a very good addition. Thank you.